everybody. Welcome to the Dunce's Corner. It has been a century since we've done our last episode, and there are many reasons for that. But I am Dr. Brian Pedraza, and happy to join you again. And joining us for the very first, second time is Matt. How's it going, Matt?
It's going good. Like you said, this is my first time on the podcast, but in a much more real sense, this isn't my first time on the podcast.
Yeah, I don't know how that's possible, but physics, I think.
Maybe this will make it to the air.
Maybe. And that's Rachel chiming in with a snide comment. Hey, Rachel, how's it going?
Good.
Good. Yeah, how's your theological career progressing at FRANU?
Oh, well, I've declared a major, so it's progressing much rapidly than it was before.
Yay! And then joining us for the very first time is Sister Marie Refugio, the powerhouse. Sister, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is a pleasure, and I'm excited to see how it goes.
How'd you find your way to FRANU, Sister?
Well, Jesus and the habit, to be one. But, you know, looking to pursue further my studies and community discerning of where that was going to go after first vows. And they happened to be visiting Louisiana and then happened to come upon a priest. And the priest was like, oh, let me tell you about this school that's offering a bachelor's in theology. And FRANU was the one. And then we were shipped to Louisiana.
Wow. Yeah. Who was the priest?
Father Josh.
Thank you, Father Josh. You're the man. Appreciate that. No, seriously, you and Sister Mercedes bring so much life to our community. So really pumped to have you here.
We're grateful to be here. I mean, it's been a gift. It feels like we've been here longer, but this is only our second year. So
right. And there are only so many sisters who can beat Father Josh in basketball so easily. So we're glad to have you.
Thanks.
Hear that, Father? And then last but not least, we have a very special guest. Dr. Angela Franks is joining us all the way from Boston because she's delivering some awesome bioethics lectures over the next 2 days. Dr. Franks, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. So glad to be here. And I'm appreciating the warm weather, though it's a little bit warm. It could be a little bit more temperate, but that's okay.
Yes, my brow is misty right now as we speak. So I thought I would kick things off, Dr. Frank, since we have you here. Let's not waste any time. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your story. You are a Catholic theologian. You teach at St. John's Seminary. But if you are willing to give us a little bit of a sneak peek behind the curtain, so to speak, how is it that you are someone who loves the Lord, loves the Catholic faith, and then how is it that you found your way into being a theologian?
Yeah, you told me you were going to ask me this about 10 seconds ago, this is very unprepared, but that's probably good.
We're just warming you up for tonight.
Exactly, you know? Yeah, the tough questions coming left and right. I was a cradle Catholic. My mom is a convert. My dad was cradle Catholic also. I just always was interested in religious stuff. Like, I just always, you know, had the gift of faith, thank God, and it was always interesting to me. I was also an intellectual. You know, I liked to think about hard stuff. And I didn't know it's not like I grew up thinking, I'm going to be a theologian. I don't think I would have known what a theologian was exactly. But yeah, God really, you know, did good things in my life. There were definitely times where I was a bit of a hot mess, and God really stepped up and did his God thing for me. So I was very grateful for that. And it just made me appreciate just the majesty of God, and that there was a lot to explore and a lot to think about. And I kind of had experienced that personally, but I went to a great book school, and like the registrar made out 3 different courses of study because I was like, maybe I'll be an English major, or maybe I'll be a history major, or maybe I'll be a theologian. And I ended up taking 3 theology classes my first semester just because it's what fit my schedule. And I was like, yes, that sounds cool. And then I think it was pretty soon after that, the registrar was like, Angela has chosen a major. I ended up committing to theology. So that it happened pretty quickly once I got into an academic environment where theology was really taught beautifully, you know, where it was just really exciting and beautiful, and that's what I wanted. Mm.
Too bad history was taught at 8 a.m. or else things could have been different, you know?
Like, that's happened to all my pre-med friends who became English majors after the 8 a.m. chemistry class.
Sounds so about right.
I'm also trying to imagine a very intelligent kid being a hot mess. Like, were you creating biological organisms in the backyard or... Like, what does that even mean?
It wasn't that kind of sci-fi. Oh, I mean, like, intelligent kids can definitely, I mean, like, it's almost kind of worse because it's like we don't stop thinking. And it's like, also, like we have this sense, like, well, you know, people say I think well. And so this must mean I have to, like, think my way out of all of my problems. And in fact, like, that's usually the exact wrong thing that I need to do. Like, usually I need to give up my thinking and give God a chance to insert his wisdom and his truth into my life. But yeah, so I like think that like there can be a lot of pride where we can be like, I just have to think harder and will stronger. Like that's, yeah, that's that is a recipe for a hot mess, I think.
Okay, gotcha. So Matt, I'm just curious. So you're an intelligent guy. I don't know if you'd describe yourself as a hot mess, but
you know, at times.
In your household, knowing I know your sisters, dare I guess who causes the most trouble in the house? But, you know, how do you get your way out of stuff?
Define stuff.
You know, things. Things when your parents are like, Matt, what do you do? Do you take it? You own up?
Yeah, I own up to it most of the time.
Good man. That's what I figured.
Yeah, if I could push it on somebody else, you know, all right. There's that option. But you know,
okay, got it.
Hopefully,
like a sibling.
Yeah,
a sibling.
Hopefully, yeah. My sister doesn't listen, or my sisters don't listen to this podcast. But you know,
yeah, I think the chances are pretty high they're going to listen. So, yeah, I have a guess which one you would push things on, but I'm not going to name her out loud. So anyway, Dr. Franks, I have before me an incredible article that you wrote for Church Life Journal from University of Notre Dame's McGrath Institute, and it is entitled, I don't know if Artur came up with this title, or you did, but Why Does Higher Ed Throw Women Under the Bus?
That's definitely Artur.
That's punchy.
I think my original title is actually in the web link, and it's something like Disadvantages of University Treatment of Women or something. Yeah. And then Archer was like, yoink.
Nice. All right. Well, this was a punchy one. Good job, Artur. And I just want to maybe read a little bit of the opening here. So you say, in a characteristically hysterical article, and what's crazy is, as I was reading this, it was like, this is not a parody, you know, but it should be a parody. But on the post-Roe world, in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, various executives bemoan the new landscape of university life. In states where women cannot obtain abortions, colleges will need to provide new services, the bureaucrats realize. The National Women's Law Center's director of educational equity complained that, quote, we're going to see a flow of pregnant and parenting students into spaces that are already not doing a great job serving that student population. End quote. The article's author expounded another quote, more students will need lactation rooms to express milk for their infants, as well as flexible schedules if they have medical complications during pregnancy. They may need access to childcare and more financial assistance. End quote. So obviously the person who's making this statement thinks of these things as a burden. And that just strikes me like, wait a minute, this is not a parody? Like they're worried that they're going to have to provide these sorts of things. So, Dr. Franks, I mean, knowing that this is where you're starting off with this article, what is, I guess, what's the underlying disease here? Maybe that's too harsh. You know, I don't know the woman who's making this quote or sort of thing, but what's your diagnosis? Like, what do you think is going on?
Yeah, I think that one line is really telling where the woman says, we're already not doing a great job of providing services to this population. And it's like, okay, So the obvious response to that would be, well, let's try to do a better job at providing services to this population. And the list that the other woman proceeds to give is, you know, not a comprehensive thing, but it's a pretty good start, you know, like more financial assistance, access to childcare, you know, help with breastfeeding, that sort of thing. And the idea that, again, like, well, now, gosh darn it, we have to do this because they might not be able to get their abortion. You know, it goes to show that the whole lie between the whole pro-choice rhetoric, which I don't even know if activists use that language very much anymore, but you know, it used to be this idea that, well, abortion is just a choice, and like what women need are choices, and we're just kind of neutrally providing these choices. And that's never been how society has been structured, and certainly how universities have been structured, because in fact there's always been this thumb on the scale pushing women toward one choice, which is the quote-unquote easy choice. It's easy for universities and employers and so forth to just be like, hey, we'll deal with this issue by getting rid of the baby, and now we can just pretend like everything's back to normal. Of course, it's not nearly that easy for the women who go through it, and of course, it's fatal to the children who go through it. It's really, I think, a desire to dictate how women should deal with pregnancy, which is mostly to not pursue pregnancy, to, you know, go earn money, get your STEM degree. Nothing wrong with STEM degrees, but, you know, like this very bean counting kind of mindset.
Yeah, I was thinking of what the title of this episode of the Dentist's Corner would be, and I was thinking to myself, like, it's a man's world, and that sucks. In some sense, right? Because, I mean, I think essentially what you're getting at in this article, which was so poignant for me to read, because to be completely honest, these aren't things that I've thought, spent too much time thinking about. I will give an example of where I have thought about this with my wife, Adrian, but you're explaining how higher education is really built for men. I mean, that's sort of the way that everything has been built up. And so for women to actually be women, and the possibility that comes of childbearing and child rearing, I mean, men, of course, need to help with child rearing, but we don't have a system that's really set up to help women succeed there. And we essentially say, you're going to have to act like a man if you're going to make it in higher ed. And you were telling a little bit of your own story about, you know, some sacrifices that you've made, right, to be where you are right now in your own career.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, to give the universities cut them a little bit of slack. I mean, originally this was designed for men. I mean, right. Pretty straightforwardly from the beginning of the university system, it was designed for men. That's just the fact of it, you know, so 1,000 years ago, that's how things were. But, you know, when the university started to welcome women in, it was like there was this unspoken contract of essentially, we'll let you in, just act like a man. Right. You know, like just pretend that you can't get pregnant, or you don't want to get pregnant, you know, or avoid relationships back before they had contraception or whatever. But like, even with all the technological change that's happened, so now we have contraception, we have abortion, all of this kind of thing, women still get pregnant because those methods are not foolproof, but also because women want to get pregnant, you know, women want to have babies. And so there, it's like the universities have been able to get away with just saying, well, just don't bother us with that kind of thing. Like, just act like a man. And so, I mean, and let's specify, like a fallen man, because as you say, you know, a healthy guy wants to be involved with rearing kids and everything. But right. But just according to how we're built, women have a greater, there's just, we have to give more in the process of pregnancy and child rearing. Like, we're more is asked of us. And that should be recognized as a social good, that women are caring for kids. And that, so it should be something that we're looking to foster, and where we want women to be able to get educations and to be able to be in the working world if they want, but where that is not an either or choice, you know, where it's like either you pursue a career or you pursue kids. And then, you know, women aren't really contributing the way that they could.
Yeah. I mean, it took just one Christmas when we were visiting California and Adrienne caught like the flu, unfortunately, right? Visiting my parents, she's flu. She's in bed like the entire time. So it's me and our oldest son, but he was so little back then. And I remember I just had one email to send. And this was the first time it was just like me and him. Like I'm solely responsible for taking care of him. One email. And it took like 45 minutes to send the email. And after that, I was like, you're the most amazing human being, Adrienne. Like, I love you so much. Why was it so hard for me to send one email right now? This is nuts. And I don't cease to tell people that she's the hardest worker in the family. You know, she's a stay-at-home mom. She homeschools the kids. The amount of sacrifice that women give never ceases to amaze me. But I don't know, like, is this something that you think about, Rachel, when it comes to your education, the career that you want? And I'm asking this because the one time that Adrienne and I had to think about this like seriously was when we were about to get married, and one of my friends from California, she's happily married, she's super intelligent, she has a master's degree, and she like just straight out said to us, I wish I had never gotten my master's degree. And we were like, whoa, okay. You know, Adrienne was in grad school, was thinking about going to grad school. And she was like, yeah, I just want to be a mom and raise my kids. And I basically just caused a massive amount of debt for my family. And then it caused us some turmoil, right? Like, wait a minute. Like, Adrienne wants to get a master's degree. We obviously want to have kids. She would like to raise them, spend a lot of time at home. Like, this is putting a lot of tension on us. Like, how are we supposed to figure this thing out? So, I don't know. Is this something that has come up in your mind before?
Yeah. I mean, I would arguably say, I know you know this, like, I'm a non-traditional student. I didn't come to the university right out of high school. And a lot of it had to do with the desire of, like, I don't want to take on debt to further my education. I don't want to, like, in my opinion, like, that idea is kind of, like, burdensome. Like, even still, I'm like, oh, man, like I really don't want to finish with debt, right? And it's a conversation that we've had multiple times, like, as far as me being here. And especially because, like, the reality is I'm studying theology with the hopes of working for the church.
Theology is so lucrative.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're the just in it for the itself, money.
You know? The church itself. Right. We make the big bucks here. And just the reality of, like I know, like, medical leave for a woman in our diocese is not paid leave. So, like, if I am working for the church, if I do get married, if I do decide to have a family, like, you know, to some degree, like, I don't know what that will look like, obviously. And so it's definitely something that I've thought about, especially because, yeah, I would love, like, I was homeschooled, and so I'd love the opportunity to homeschool my children, and to be, like, we kind of live on a mini farm, so I don't know if I want to live on a farm, but, like, I like the idea of, like having this availability of, like, self-sustainability, and, like, the reality is that requires someone staying home, and, like, that would definitely be a sacrifice I'd be willing to make, but it's definitely the idea of, like, if I were to further pursue education, even beyond just a bachelor's, like, you do accrue debt, right? Like, higher education is expensive.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's definitely something that I've thought about.
I know. I give my, as you know, Matt, I give my catechesis students the talk about when you study theology.
That's
right?
A fun one. That's, yeah, a real fun one.
It's like, here's the average salary of a youth minister in the country. Here's the healthcare premiums that you pay for our diocese.
You have a little mini heart attack whenever, yeah, you flip that sheet of paper over. You're just like, ooh, yeah, wait a minute.
I mean, I was working in a parish before I came here. And even just being in a parish as a single person, I was like I couldn't, like, there's no way that, granted, I wouldn't be doing it alone, but, like, I could not have provided for a family on that kind of, you know.
Right. And I know the diocese wants to do better, but, man, I don't know what it's going to take, but I want to do something about it. So I pray about it, and maybe I write about it. Yeah. And I, you know, we're sending graduates out into the world and we want them to serve this community. And I know that's a big task. So yeah, Dr. Franks, I mean, you probably remember a number of years ago that conversation came out mostly amongst like CEOs, that sort of a thing. And then it spread, but it's like, can a woman have it all?
Yeah.
Right. Like, what's your answer?
I didn't invent this answer, but I've heard it before, that a woman can possibly have it all, but she can probably not have it all at once.
Oh.
So in other words, like, and this is part of what I argue in that article, that it, what needs to be more normalized in academia, but in other fields as well, is that women have seasons in their lives that men do not have. You know, I mean, the male, God bless him, he's like, you know, if he's fertile, he's always fertile, you know, until he's like, I don't know how old, you know, like women, we have rhythms, you know, and that kind of marks us not just like monthly, but also like across our life, right? And so, you know, our prime fertility hits in our 20s, you know, into like a little bit into our 30s, right? And then it starts to go downhill. For some people, it goes downhill very, very sharply. You can't reasonably wait until you're 35 or 39 or certainly 41 to have a kid. Like, it's just, it's not reasonable. Like, some people do. It takes a lot of technology most of the time. I mean, you know, I had a baby at 41 with no technology. So that God does provide that sometimes. But like, there's all kinds of moral concerns with that. Like, it's just, it's not the way our bodies are meant to function. And so You really have to give women space that if they're called to marriage, that they're able to have those relationships early when they're still fertile, which means that they might be contributing to the working world, like they're obviously contributing in their family, but they might be contributing in the working world later. Like, they might come back, you know, they might be an atraditional student like Rachel here. They might like take some time off. They might take a lot of time off. They might come back later, get their degrees, go to grad school later, do all of that later. And we shouldn't look at those resumes, you know, with this jaded eye, like, what were they doing? You know, well, they were doing really important work. They were really helping form the next generation. It was really important service. But yet that time ends and kids move away. And, you know, like, women have always worked. It's just that before industrialization, women worked in the house doing things that you could do when there were little kids around. And so, like, we have to make it possible for women to continue to work and to do things that give them enjoyment and occupation, but not expect them to have a male timetable.
Mm-hmm. And I was gonna like beg the question of, because this touches like my family personally, of like, what can we do to help the stigma in that way? Because like, my mom found out she was pregnant with me and my twin brother and had to like stop nursing school and like shut off that part of her life because it just wasn't feasible at the time and she didn't have the resources to provide for her. And so she ended up not going back to school until my littlest brother. So four more of us were born, and then she went back to pursue her degree. But then in that process, like, she brought my little brother with her to school, and just, it wasn't feasible. Like, it was, I remember going to classes with my mom and like rocking my little brother, like, and like helping her as she was trying to study for her exam. And then like, she would be in bed studying while like all of us were asleep because that was the time that she had. And then even now, my little sister, she actually just had her baby, but like, school was like, you get a day off. Like, that's it. And then work was like, you don't get any time off because you're only part-time. And then she had to do this, that, and the other to get full-time so she could get benefits and paid leave. And so it was like, as she's pregnant, as she's dealing with this, she was like stressing of, how am I going to make this work? Like, I desire this baby. I'm excited for this baby, but I also am like, I don't want to bring this baby into like crisis. And it wasn't like, abortion was not on the mindset, like in that realm, but it was just like, they didn't make it easy. And so it was like stressful. It's just like, how do we help women in that way?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me that one of the things that is deeply embedded in this conversation is the way that our culture looks at children or devalues children. Mm-hmm. So my director for my PhD, John Grabowski, in one of his most recent books, he's talking about the Industrial Revolution and that shifted the way that we view children, because previous to that, children and the family worked out of the home. I mean, it was a family project to do work together. I mean, Rachel, you live on a farm. You sort of know what that's like, right? For everybody, all hands are involved in that sort of a thing. But with the Industrial Revolution, work leaves the home. And now it's a burden if you have a child, right? Because that means you can't easily go and do the work that you need to do. And this has now just become so regular in our culture that, I mean, I think whenever young people like Adrian and I will be mentors for married couples, whenever people bring up marriage to a young couple and they talk about having kids, like the first thing that people say is like, and I know they're like kidding and everything halfway, but it's always like, well, you'll get sleep like in about 20 years and things like that, right? It's just like every comment about kids is about how much of an immense burden it's going to be for you to have kids. And that happened to us when we were engaged. And then, God bless her, a really good friend of mine from back home, Kim, said, you know what, Brian? I bet a lot of people have been telling you how hard it is to have kids. And you know, they're not wrong. It's an immense sacrifice. But she said, I can't even remember what my life would be without my kids. Like, they are so important. Like, they're so valuable to us. Like, our life is way better now that we have kids. And just to hear that from someone that was like, oh, this is actually like good, you know, like having kids can actually be a joy. Like, there are, you know, really important things that happen for a family when it grows. And that just amazed me. But our culture just seems to be so against having children.
Yeah, there's some of the stuff I've done work on is the history of the birth control movement. A lot of the rhetoric around contraception was designed to drive a wedge between a woman and her body, her fertility in particular, her fertile body. So it's like, you know, a woman's body might be ornamental, it might be there to charm people or to attract people or whatever. But the idea that all the stuff that for a woman can be really irritating, like, you know, your fertility and, you know, all the things around your hormones and everything, but that all of that has this really important purpose that is actually deeply impressive and really amazing. That's something that we don't naturally go to. And I didn't, even growing up as a Catholic, like, I didn't naturally see that either, I would say, you know, like, and I was pretty tomboy of a kid and I didn't really want to babysit. I'd never really babysat kids or whatever. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to really, like, the thought of being a mother just wasn't, it wasn't like I sat around thinking, oh, I can't wait till I can be a mother and bake cookies or whatever the Hillary Clinton put down was or whatever.
I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was to fulfill my profession, which I entered before my husband was in public life.
Like, I didn't really relate to that kind of thinking either, you know? And then when it happened to me, it was like so transformative. The experience of like the power of the female body and what it can do and how important it is for other human beings. And we're used, because contraception set up this mentality that babies are somehow optional to the whole sex thing. And there's this great line by a Catholic novelist, David Lodge. He said, in novels, life is all about sex. And in real life, it's all about babies. And, you know, like there, we have this kind of shiny picture through Hollywood and everything else of, like, you know, about like the value of like being sexy and having this, like, you know, all of this around sex. And it's like children are really an afterthought. And that just makes kids optional. And it also means, like, when we do want them, it's almost like we have this commercial kind of commodity mindset toward them. You know, it's like, I want to, you know, I want to upgrade my iPhone. I want to upgrade my family to, you know, one kid or two kids or three kids or whatever. You know, like, it's really easy to fall into that because we think it's just optional. It's just my choice. And instead, it's like the whole kind of trajectory of a marriage, of male bodies and female bodies, is to lead to this life that really is life-giving for everybody.
Yeah. I wasn't planning on heading this direction, but it just, you know, strikes me that it might be helpful in this conversation. You and I have written on John Paul II, spent a lot of time with this thought. And of course, he's the one who coined the phrase, like, the feminine genius. How do you describe that? Like, what is it? Like, when you have students who are asking, mm-hmm. what does John Paul mean when he says the feminine genius? What is it?
Yeah. So I think it's primarily a genius for persons, for relationship. I have a colleague, Deborah Savage, who writes really beautifully on the Genesis accounts of the creation of man and woman. And the second creation account of Adam kind of being brought into this horizon of things and of animals and of like the garden. And then the woman is brought into this horizon of persons, like he's the first thing that she sees. And so both of those are good and important. Like we need, you know, Deborah says, you know, if we didn't have men, we would still be living in caves, you know, like we need that genius for things and accomplishment and innovation. And we also need that genius for persons, which again, like I didn't particularly feel like I had per se when I was growing up. But I think the possibility of pregnancy in a woman like unlocks this it's rooted in our biology. It's actually this biological capacity to nurture that then we can bring our whole self to that project.
That's powerful. Sister, I want to tread lightly in asking you this question, but I know, for instance, Sister Martha Ann on campus has talked about how initially she was going to be married. I think she was engaged to a guy. And it was hard for her to give up the idea of having like her own biological children, so to speak. But sisters still have an incredible role in their spiritual motherhood. So is this something, I imagine it is, but is this something that you thought about when you're entering your own vocation? And, you know, how are you seeing, I guess, motherhood play itself out in your life right now?
I mean, when I entered religious life, I had no idea. Like, that's a whole nother story there of just what I was getting myself into. Like, I didn't know what discernment was. I didn't really know.
What do you mean, poverty?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know the fullness of things. And that was the Lord's mercy in that, because if I did, I probably would have been like, no, not for me. But the Lord knows. I mean, going into religious life, I wanted a family. I come from a big family. I desired like to give birth to my own children. Like Rachel was saying, just all of these things, like still are on my heart, but it's just being fulfilled in a new way. And I mean, I grew up as a student of the Mercedarian sisters. And so I saw this lived out throughout my kindergarten through, eighth grade years and like through the rest of my siblings' years too, of how this was played out of like sisters nurturing our faith and just like us as children. And like, I loved being able to play at recess with them. I was like, wow, that's so cool. And now I'm seeing the fruit of that, of like, I'm in my second year of, temporary vows and just like seeing the spiritual motherhood like blossom in my own heart. Like, I've always had that special gift in my heart of like knowing the need before it's like spoken, or like I can just see it. Like my mom would say, like, see the need, fill the need. And I just do that. And so like, it's just really beautiful being able to do that with the children now and just seeing like my heart still expand as a mother for them, but just like, I haven't given physical birth to them, but like spiritually, like I have in a sense. And so, yeah, it's actually a topic that I'm just like delving more into of like, Mary, please increase my motherly heart. And like throughout my formation, it was the prayer of like, I want to be able to give birth to Jesus wherever I go and like hold him in my womb also, so I can birth that to those I meet. And so, yeah, it's a very tender topic for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, I think true to your name, Marie Refugio, I feel like I've seen you be like a motherly refuge for our theology students, you know? Like you and Sister Mercedes, like in class, they just like, yeah. You know, they scoot next to you guys like, I love being around these sisters. There's something about your presence.
I mean, I think they'd beg to differ, but yeah.
A lot of pins being dropped.
Oh.
I was saying, sometimes they're quite mischievous.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah.
They'll steal your goldfish. Watch out.
Communal goldfish, let's be real.
That's right. Yeah, when it's communal, it's not stolen.
I don't know. I don't think the rest of us took that vow, so.
All right, we're not going to get into distinctions now. but yeah, I mean, that was my whole like prayer before, upon profession, was like, we're allowed to add a name, at a title. And I, in prayer, like I had that prayer of like, Mary, like help me be like you and like encompass all of that in my being. And so I wanted to continue that of like, my middle name is already Marie and Refugio is our mother foundress's name. And so the first thought was like Mary of refuge. And so, yeah, that was the idea of just, I really want to be like Mary and I want to be a refuge to all, not just those who are in the faith, but those who are sinners, those who are downcast, those who are away, so I can be a refuge and lead them to Jesus. So, yeah.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
I love it, sister. Yeah. Yeah, I've brought this up in the podcast before, but just thinking about the feminine genius, because Matt and I are over here like, man, not much to add to this conversation, right? But Matt is saying yes right now. I've mentioned this before, but I think one of the most powerful ways that I've experienced it was the birth of our first child, because with the first kid, you like lay out the birth plan and you have the bouncy ball and the Christmas lights and, you know, all of the stuff, you know, you want it to be perfect. Yeah. That's a thing. It's a thing. Birth plans. Look it up. But
I was more contemplating the Christmas lights.
Yeah. Yeah. It creates a vibe. You can turn off the, yeah.
Why were there Christmas
lights?
Say,
I was just wondering if that was like necessary for the birth process. Like no, I've never been so present, but
a woman
I have
can
lots
choose,
of young siblings.
Can choose how she wants this birth to go as best as she can. Right.
Christmas
and it's a high money operation in a hospital, to be completely honest, which is why the birthing wing looks nearly like a hotel. Mm-hmm. Like it's, they know they get so much money out of this. And so some physicians and nurses are, you know, they know that a lot of moms are going to come in with like a plan, like this is how I want this thing to go. And it includes how, what sort of medications you are willing to take or not willing to take and things like that. So one of the things that we brought was like my giant wooden crucifix. And I put it on the windowsill beyond where Adrian was, and we had like a electric candle or whatever going on. And so I'm the only one in the room who can really see it like this, but it's like, here's Adrian before me, like on the bed in pain to bring life into the world. And then beyond her is this image of our Lord, like on the cross, undergoing this immense suffering in order to bring life to the world. And it was just, I mean, it dawned on me the sort of Christ-likeness of a mother in this moment of birth. Like that was like the feminine genius. Like it just washed over me like in this moment. I was just so moved by what was going on. And so, you know, motherhood, it's the real deal. It is totally the real deal. So real quick, I do have a game that I want us to play, but Dr. Franks, if you wouldn't mind, so I've asked you to come to the university to actually help our community in the conversation about gender, and especially those people who are struggling with their identity, those who experience gender dysphoria. Maybe give us just like a, you know, a little teaser when it comes to your talk tonight, and maybe as a segue, since we've been talking about how, you know, women living in a quote unquote man's world, so to speak, I was struck in reading the literature on the Tavistock Center in the UK, which was their only pediatric gender transition center. And it recently was closed in part because of a lawsuit and in part because of an independent study was done on the things that happened there. And the person who wrote the study came back with some pretty damning facts about the way that things had gone there. But one of the stats that came from reading Abigail Favalli's book was that in the past decade, about the number of people seeking transitions, 2,000-3,000%, just like immensely blew up, and that about 70% are young women, like teenage women, like. What's happening? Like, what do you think is going on there?
Yeah. And she mentions that that's a flip where it used to be, you know, when the Tavistock Center was probably set up, you would have been, you know, the majority would have been boys, where it was a different kind of phenomenon. Yeah, I think a big part, you know, I think Abigail has, Favalli has talked about this, that in a sense, gender dysphoria or gender issues, they're like the new eating disorders. And obviously, we still have eating disorders around too, but eating disorders are a primarily feminine phenomenon as well. And it, what you see there is this relationship with the female body that is one of antagonism. So this antagonistic relationship of a girl toward her body, and fraught with a lot of fear around things like sexuality. I mean, we live in a world in which porn is incredibly violent and also incredibly pervasive, and girls learn that. They know that is out there. And so there's just all of this fear around relationships and around the sexual power, the reproductive power of their body. And I think that eating disorders are one way of dealing with that, and just desiring to get out of this body, you know, be this anonymous guy. You know, like, I think there's a lot of desire for safety. There's also, there's a lot of identity problems around this, you know, where it's like, and this is something that comes out in eating disorders too, where people are like, well, my identity is to be the thinnest person in the room. Like, that's my identity. And I think that with gender, there's a lot of a similar thing. Like, my identity is to be genderqueer. It's to not fit into your boxes. You know, it's to be unusual. Like, I can be unusual here. And everybody thinks it's great, online or whatever. So, yeah, I think it's similar to a lot of the stuff we've been talking about in this podcast.
Right, yeah. I don't know if you all have seen those, the Dove commercials where they're talking about like what real beauty is, and they'll often take like young girls, and like one of them is they have other people sort of draw what that person looks like, and then when they bring the actual people in to see the drawings, they see this like beautiful figure and they just like start bawling because in their eyes, like, I don't look like that. Like, I'm ugly, you know, like, this is not like who I am. And another one was they had girls and their moms, and they asked both, like, do you think your daughter is like affected by sort of like all of the advertisements on social media for cosmetics and the way that people look and diets and things like that? And both of them were like, no, she's smart enough like to get this sort of a thing. And then they basically take the girls scrolling and they take the voices and they use a computer program to make it their mom's face, who's actually saying all of the things that are on their walls on their social media. And it's just like breathtaking, right? To have like a mom figure like talking about how you can saw away your teeth to make them perfect, and other things that you need to do to your body. And just both the girls and their mothers kind of looking at each other like, oh my gosh, I guess I have been like listening to this stuff, and it really has been seeping in, you know, to their subconscious. So I just feel like there's so many things that are out there that are really affecting. I know it could affect young men as well when they're thinking about their bodies. But I mean, we just have this sort of culture where the pressure is especially on young women to have a particular kind of body or the way that they present themselves to others.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm just thinking a little bit about what you had said, specifically about this has been a hot topic on campus. So I'm taking a course where we've talked about gender ideology. And it's just hard, like in our section where we were talking about gender, like I mean, this is a Catholic university, and just like shocked by the amount of people that are just like, yeah, no, it's okay. Like, no, it's not okay. And like, we need to learn how to like articulate that. And just like what you were saying about I forgot exactly how you said it, but it just made me think of like Satan specifically wants to attack women, right? Like, I think of Mary in this sense, like he doesn't like her, like he hates her, you know? It's like, why would he think any different of like me as a woman? Like, he's going to hate me because I'm a woman who strives for that same sort of, you know, virtue. And, I don't know, that just really struck me. Like, it totally makes sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but like, it totally makes sense that this would be the group affected, you know? And like you said, not to say that, you know, men aren't affected, but like, just in particular, women, and even, you know, like myself, I'm on social media, and it is hard sometimes to be like, you're looking at this thing that you know is fake, And you have to like tell yourself, you know, like this isn't real. Like this is social media. Like I know that I'm looking at something that's curated and probably touched up and like all of these things. But even as a like a grown woman, mm-hmm. it's hard. And so I think of, you know, I had shared recently like my little sisters. I have three younger sisters. And I recently watched one of them go through this like, gosh, I don't even know what to call it. But, you know, like she's on social media and like girls are mean.
Yeah.
You know? And so just like as an older sister, watching these things happen is heartbreaking, you know? And I don't know. I just can't help but think of like where are we going, you know? Like where's the end? Like what's the end, you know? Like is it people speaking out and taking a stand? Or what, you know? I don't know.
Like that's my whole question of like this topic of like us as like in the church, like what is the desire for us to like move forward in this? Like how can we be cultivating a culture that is like helpful in a way of like, because like I get begged the question now of like, because I'm in this habit, like I hate those people. And like I've gotten those comments before of like, well, you hate me because what you're wearing. And it's like, no, but how do I bridge the gap of like, I love you as you are, but like the choices that you make, like that is where we come to like divide. But like, how do I see them like with love, treat them with love because I want to, but they reject that immediately because of they just see the church as this big no to them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this super important conversation, mm-hmm. this is totally whets the appetite. So, I mean, this podcast is going to come out after Dr. Frank's talks, but we are going to upload them to YouTube so people can check them out and see the insights that you have to help us in our community. The one thing I'll leave us on this note before we go to the game is, you know, John Paul II, one of his most simple, I think most impactful teachings is the fact that Jesus Christ is the answer to the question that is the human person. So I think the job of the disciple is to think about the heart of the people who are undergoing this, the hearts of the people who think that it's fine, and to say, like, what's the thing that they're actually after, right? They're after something. They're restless, to use the Augustinian term, right? They're looking for that peace that they only find in Christ. And so being able to tap into that is going to help, I think, in our evangelizing efforts to see, figure out what it is that they're actually seeking. But let's play a game, folks.
So, boy.
We are in the midst of Lent, and it's sort of a dunce's tradition. You have a tradition when you've done this once or twice before. We're going to play the game, What's the Worst Penance? Okay, so for each of you, since I'm the one who had to come up with the game, sorry, I'm not a player, but the rest wow. of you
we
are.
We see how it is.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
That's sus, as my we kids would say.
We could come up with one real fast. Oh, yeah,
we could. So I'm just going to offer you two things, and you've got to tell us which is the worst penance, okay? Boy. So I'm going to kick things off with Rachel. Rachel, are you ready to roll?
Of course.
Which is the worst penance? Listening to the It's Corn song or to You Are My Sunshine for 24 hours straight?
24 hours? Is this like just 24 hours, like no options? Or is this like every time I listen to music for 24 hours?
No, like you're going to have headphones in your ears for 24 hours Ooh. And you either get the It's Corn or You Are My Sunshine.
Does she get to watch the It's Corn music video?
Yeah, that's fine.
Here's the thing. I also feel like you could answer this question, Dr. Pedroza.
Yeah? Why is that?
Because I think that It's Corn song is your favorite, actually.
No, I just know all the youngins are into that thing.
No, yeah. That was last
that
semester.
That was a long time ago.
It's like Paleozoic okay. age.
Yeah. The worst penance. Do I get to choose who's singing it to me?
No.
Well, I don't know if I've ever heard a recorded version of the, not the It's Corn.
You Are My Sunshine.
You Are My Sunshine.
Let's say it's Matt singing.
Oh,
that's the worst penance.
That's the worst penance. Okay. Right. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, Matt.
Okay. Matt, we're going to you. So tell me, what's the worst penance? A big sweaty hug from Nick Saban or from Pete Carroll?
I don't hate Pete Carroll.
Oh, so okay. So the Nick Saban sweaty hug's the worst.
Yeah. I mean, let's say like I'm consoling him after LSU beats him in overtime on a walk-off two-point conversion. I would be happy in that moment. So it's based off the context of the hug.
Okay.
If it's reversed, I don't want to even see the man. But Pete Carroll's, you know, that's the good option.
Okay. The backstory behind this, Dr. Franks, is LSU is a massive... Baton Rouge is an LSU town. LSU football is a big deal.
LSU is a religion here.
Go Gators.
Some. Yes.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
And Nick Saban was the head coach, and then he left for Alabama. So, yeah, there's a lot of animosity, shall we say, Matt, towards Nick Saban.
I hear he's a good Catholic, so there's that going for him, I guess.
Oh, good man. Good man.
He there gets you go. Some points.
I like that. Okay, Sister Marie Refugio, you are up next. Which is the worst penance?
Oh boy.
I just want to know. Tread lightly. We're trying to peel back the curtain behind the convent.
Yeah.
You know? What's the worst penance? That. A sister who constantly cracks her toes during silent prayer, or the sister who whisper prays to herself?
Oh man.
Cracks her toes? Yeah. That's so oddly specific.
Someone's had personal experiences with that.
I was about to be honest. I think I'm the one that cracks my toes during
curtain was peeled away.
I mean, everything cracks in my body, so it's just like I'm trying to be better about not doing it in prayer, but here we are.
Yeah.
I'd have to say the whisper prayer.
The whisper prayer.
Yeah.
That can be rough, right? In adoration, supposed to be silent, and someone's.
Yeah, because you can't.
Someone's under their breath, like, Hail Mary, full of grace.
Yeah. Right. You know, takes me out of my zone.
It does, especially when you're in like a presence of silence. It's just like, what is that?
It's the sister to your left.
I'm glad you didn't rat out anybody except yourself.
It's yeah, good. No, I'm usually the rascal. So,
facts. I have to can confirm. I don't live at the convent, but I see her enough.
All right. So, Dr. Franks is anxiously awaiting her first round. Yeah,
so
here we
anxious.
Go. I only have two rounds here. So. Ending round one. Dr. Franks, which is the worst penance? Having to go without the Oxford comma or having to put two spaces after every period?
Ooh, dang.
Yeah, I knew that. See?
That was harsh. Uh-huh. I think getting rid of the Oxford comma.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so necessary.
It's so necessary. I'm totally in agreement with you. Yeah, I don't understand people who don't use it. So weird.
We love you, but we're concerned about you.
Probably why some of my papers have been graded.
I was going to say, we're all sitting around the table like, what?
I love you like Nick Saban. Okay, Rachel, back to you. Which is the worst penance? Getting a giant ashy cross on your forehead, a.k.a. the Father's Revenge, for the rest of your life, or having the lyrics, "It's Got the Juice," tattooed on your arm, but with the word juice misspelled as J-O-O-S-E.
That's just
oh my gosh.
You got to have one for the rest of your life.
You thought about this in 2 minutes?
I did. Pretty creative sometimes.
Okay, so here's the thing. I think the worst it's penance the would be that. I'm not about juice tattoos. That's just gross. But I also think that the ash cross is only okay if it's done out of love. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, yeah.
So from experience, the terrible crosses have always been out of like paternal...
Well, you don't think that's love? You don't think Father's Revenge is love?
It's like I love you so much I want you to look like an idiot for the rest of the day, you know? Okay.
But still, the worst is it's got the J-O-O-S-E juice.
Yeah, my body is a temple, and it does not need the word juice on it.
All right, good to know. Matt, your second round. Which is the worst penance? Losing to Dr. Pedraza in fantasy football for the rest of your life, or LSU football losing to Alabama for the rest of your life? Think long and hard before you speak, man.
I had a feeling this one was coming, actually. For the record, one of us made the playoffs this past year and the other one didn't, with that being me making the playoffs. But I guess this is going
forward. Oh, for clarification's sake.
Yeah. See, do I want to see the city be happy, or do I want myself to be happy rest of my life?
Oh. The political question.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take the sacrifice, because that's just the person I am.
Good man. Okay.
Just so I can see, and on behalf of the city.
Right. Snaps are Matt over here.
Okay.
And we could throw Florida in there, too, as long as we beat Florida every year.
Hey, right. I mean, I'm from Ohio. I'm just repping for my sisters, so.
That's right. She's repping. Okay, you're a good man. I like that. I like the virtue that's coming out of you. You're showing love for Nick Saban in this podcast and love for the city.
I'm really trying to, you know, turn over a new leaf this Lent and, you know, bridge a gap between me and the city of Tuscaloosa, because after LSU won the title in 2019, I may or may not have walked into a McDonald's holding the Advocate with Joe Burrow holding the trophy.
In Alabama? In Tuscaloosa?
Yeah, they didn't serve me.
Oh my goodness. Are you serious?
They did not serve me.
Wow. 1 billion served, but not you. Not you.
Yeah. Whew, man, wow. Matt. All right, that's got to be really different. I like that. Respect, respect. Okay, Sister Maria Refugio, which is the worst penance? Never being allowed to play volleyball again, or never being allowed to play basketball again?
Oh, hard. Basketball right away.
Oh, that basketball is the real love.
Right? I even knew the answer to that one.
Yeah, I was like, volleyball, that's like a second thought, but basketball, oof, yeah.
That's the real love.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
All right. Father Josh and Jeremy, we need to get her on the court. She's on my team.
I'm ready.
Jeremy needs a core.
And finally, Dr. Franks, which is the worst penance? I tried hard with this one, okay? Having to read Tolkien-esque landscape descriptions of your backyard for the rest of your life, or having to read Flannery-esque descriptions of petty crime in your city for the rest of your life.
Oh, boy. I'm gonna follow Matt's lead here, because the latter sounds like there would have to be a lot of petty crime in my city, and that would definitely be worse than having a pathetic
backyard. That's such a way of weaseling out of it. Okay, I'll take it. I'll take it. Yeah. The first part of it just totally came up because I'm reading Lord of the Rings with the boys, and it's like, man, the amount of landscapes. Like, hang in there, boys.
Yeah.
It's good. We're going to get to some action. No, they've actually been really good about just kind of sitting there and trying to picture things. So, you know, the guy likes his landscapes. You know what I mean? All right, folks. So, with that being said, this is another episode of the Dunce's Corner. You can actually catch us somewhere on social media. It's been so long that I can't even remember. But I'm pretty sure it's Dunce Pod on Twitter and the Dunce's Corner on Instagram. And you can email us at duncepod@gmail.com. Believe it or not, guys, since we had Dr. Kristen Collier on our show, we received an email, and it was intensely hate mail. So one day, the next time I record the episode, I'm going to have to read it on air for you guys, as long as the words that I can say. Yeah, it was pretty intense.
It was one of those.
So, God bless you, whoever you are, who wrote that email. And
it couldn't have been targeted at me, because I wasn't on the episode. So
that's right. You weren't. This is your first and second time. And Dr. Franks, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. This was fun.
Yeah, it's been awesome having you here. All right. God bless everyone. Peace.
Wow,
wait, so Sister fitting. Ref is your nickname?
Yeah, that's what they call me.
Because you're refereeing a lot of things?
Well, because
I thought that you're the one who would be starting the...
Well, yeah, usually I am, but because I'm a big sports fan, they're like, oh, this fits you, like Sister Ref, and then...
Refugio.
Yeah, so that's where they go with it.
Nice. But, do they threaten to put black stripes?
No, not yet. Not yet. I hope not, because I don't do well with my habits already, so I don't need a stained habit.